Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Friday, the 3rd of February. Israel's Attorney General hits out at planned reforms to the justice system, saying they could give the government unlimited power. A BBC investigation finds that young protesters in Iran are being shot in the face by security forces. And in a sign of escalating tensions in the US Congress, Republicans have ousted Democrat Ilhan Omar from a powerful committee. Also in the podcast, the row over possible bugging devices in Prague Castle. And the discovery of Yiddish songs that haven't been heard since the Second World War. Plans by the new hardline government in Israel to overhaul the justice system have prompted a series of huge protests in recent weeks, with tens of thousands of people taking to the streets claiming it would mark the end of democracy. Now, the nation's attorney general has waded into the debate, saying the plan could give Benjamin Netanyahu's government unlimited power. Gali Baharov Miara wrote a 112-page opinion to the justice minister, arguing the changes would gravely damage Israel's system of checks and balances. However, Israel's minister for the economy, Nir Barkat, told the BBC that many of the changes would align Israel's system with those of other democracies.
I'm a strong believer in democracy, and Israel is the only democracy in our region. And I'm telling you that I feel very comfortable with the changes that we have on the table on the democratic side and the balance of powers. And we're looking to be closer to our European peers. And eventually, I believe we'll get an arrangement where we will be more like other countries in the world versus not. Right now, the balance of power in Israel is extreme. And we want to return it to be similar to what happens in the democratic world.
Nir Barkat. Well, I heard more about the debate from our Middle East regional editor, Sebastian Usher.
This is a new government that's been described as the most far right in Israel's history. And I think they see the judiciary as it stands now as too soft, too liberal. And they want to take them down a peg and they want to give the government more of a role in the way that judges, for example, even on the Supreme Court, are appointed. They want to limit the amount of power that the judges have over the government. The Supreme Court, again, in terms of being able to tackle legislation by the government that the Supreme Court may find a problem with. The opposition, which was very articulately presented today by the Attorney General, who said that her concerns were absolutely at the heart of Israeli democracy, judicial independence, and the protection of individual rights. And those are the things that have brought people out onto the streets.
Now, the Attorney General also singled out Benjamin Netanyahu himself. Why is that? And will he accept the opinion that he needs to stay out of the debate?
The way it was expressed is that because there's still a trial that he's facing on corruption charges which he denies, that this represents a conflict of interest if he is involved in changes to the judiciary. That's sort of been rejected by Netanyahu's people, and they've said that they will provide a full answer to that within the next 14 days.
Sebastian Usher. She is perhaps most famous as a member of the so-called Squad, a group of four Democratic Congresswomen of colour elected in 2018. Ilhan Omar, the first Somali-American and one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress, has long been a target of the Republicans. Now, Congresswoman Omar has been voted off the powerful Foreign Affairs Committee by the new Republican majority in the House of Representatives. A vocal supporter of Palestinian rights and a critic of the Israeli government, she's been accused of making anti-Semitic comments. Speaking before the vote, Ilhan Omar said she hadn't come to Congress to be silent.
My voice will get louder and stronger, and my leadership will be celebrated around the world as it has been. So take your vote or not, I am here to stay, and I am here to be a voice against harms around the world and advocate for a better world.
Omar is the third high-profile Democrat to be kicked off a committee since the Republican takeover. So how significant is it that she's been ousted? Isn't it natural for Republicans to replace Democrats on these committees? Question for Nomia Iqbal, our Washington correspondent.
Well, historically, the party that controls the House doesn't really go after its opponents in this way. There's not really a precedent for this, but things have changed. And a lot of the Democrats are saying that this is just political revenge because 2 years ago, the Democrats kicked off two Republicans from committees. And, you know, it's worth remembering Ilhan Omar is someone that the Republicans have been wanting to get rid of for a long time. She is just one of three Muslims in Congress, and she'd come under fire several years ago for a series of comments that were considered anti-Semitic by members of both parties. And so now, you know, they've wasted no time using their new majority to kick her off this very powerful committee. Just looking at sort of the different reactions, you've got those that say, well, this is more than that. This is, you know, they've gone after her because she's a woman of colour. That was a comment made by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's close to Omar and, like her, a progressive Democrat. And then, as I say, you've got those who say this is just political revenge, that the Republicans are just doing it because the Democrats did it 2 years ago.
Yeah, and is this likely to cause a backlash among voters?
Be interesting to see, to be honest with you. It's kind of the minutiae of Washington politics in some ways, and there's so much else that's on people's minds. It's really hard to say how much the American public care about this. I suppose it's interesting in that it tells us a lot about what the priorities of Republican lawmakers are at the moment. I guess they're deciding, well, we're just going to start giving the Democrats a taste of their own medicine. You know, I mentioned Democrats kicking two Republicans off committees, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, and they're now on committee. So what you see is the House Republicans just doing that in return. I think people will just look at it as a bit of tit for tat.
Nomia Iqbal in Washington. According to one human rights group, at least 488 people have been killed by the security forces in Iran since the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini sparked widespread protests over the hardline restrictions on women. The intensity of the demonstrations has died down in many parts of the country, a fact that is probably linked to the extremely violent crackdown by the Iranian authorities. Aside from the many fatalities, other protesters are facing life-threatening injuries, with a growing number being shot in the face with rubber bullets or metal pellets. Ophthalmologists across Iran have called for the authorities to stop this tactic. Parham Gobardi from the BBC Persian Service has been investigating and a warning that his report contains some graphic accounts of injuries.
He said to me, "Go or I shoot you in the eye."
Maryam was intentionally shot in the face by revolutionary guards while she was protesting in Tehran last October, a method used more and more by Iranian forces, wanting to put a stop to the protests.
One plainclothes agent appeared and began shooting at me with rubber bullets from about a meter and a half away. He shot me 8 times. I fell down. The same officer pointed his shotgun back at me and shot me in the eye.
BBC News identified dozens of victims all over Iran who were intentionally targeted and lost their eye as a result. Aydin is one of them.
They pointed a laser at my head and fired birdshot from a 15-meter distance. 6 pellets ended up all over my body.
According to the United Nations Human Rights Guidance on Less Lethal Weapon, kinetic impact projectiles, such as rubber bullets, should not be targeted at the head, face, and neck. And metal pellets, such as those fired from shotguns, should never be used.
A doctor removed 3 at home, but I needed to go to a hospital for the rest, as one went through my eye and landed in my sinuses, near my brain.
But the hospital is not always a safe place for wounded protesters. Salman had to flee from his hospital bed after being intentionally shot in the face by a rubber bullet.
I had to escape from the hospital because 2 officers were after me. Before going to the hospital, I didn't go home for 20 days and changed places every night.
Salman has now left the country. He said he was shot by a plainclothes officer who recognized him and identified him as a protester.
As soon as he saw me, he raised his paintball gun and shot rubber bullets at me. I lost my sight in my left eye permanently. I also suffered injuries in my teeth and skull. Due to inflammation of my brain veins, I was an inch away from becoming brain dead. I saw similar cases in the hospital, people who were shot in the eyes but with birdshot. There were 50-60 metal pellets in their bodies and 1-3 pellets in their eyes.
Salman and others we spoke to all said that despite going blind, they see light at the end of the tunnel and they will not give up.
That report by Parham Gobadi of the BBC Persian Service. A Pakistani man held prisoner at Guantanamo Bay for 16 years has been transferred to Belize. Majid Khan was captured by the US in 2003 in the wake of the September 11th attacks. He admitted in a 2012 plea deal to conspiring with al-Qaeda and has since been serving as a government witness. According to US officials, 34 detainees remain at the Guantanamo Bay detention camp. The military prison once housed hundreds of suspected militants captured during the so-called War on Terror. More details from Neda Taufik.
Majid Khan attended school in the U.S. state of Maryland, but after the September 11th attacks, he returned to Pakistan to join al-Qaeda. He was captured in Karachi in 2003 and tortured at a CIA black site. He was waterboarded, raped, deprived of food and sleep, and hung from his hands naked for days. This went on for 3 years, despite admitting early on to what he had done, until he was transferred to Guantanamo Bay. He admitted to joining a plot to assassinate Pakistan's president and to delivering $50,000 to finance a deadly bombing in Indonesia. He was sentenced to 26 years in prison, but was given a reduced sentence as part of a plea deal for acting as a U.S. government witness. In a statement released by his attorneys, Majid Khan said he intended to make the most of his second chance in Belize.
Neda Taufik. Now to a period of troubled history in South America.
Señores jueces, nunca más. Silencio en la sala.
That is a clip from a new film, Argentina 1985, which is based on the true story of a team of lawyers who dared to prosecute the generals and others who were involved in what's called the Dirty War. Nunca más, never again, became the rallying cry. No more of the horrors of the brutal military dictatorship, torture, execution, disappearances, with people being dropped out of planes. Argentina 1985 has already won a Golden Globe Award and it's been nominated for an Oscar. Santiago Mitre is the writer and director. Michelle Hussein asked him why there was so much resistance to the generals being put on trial.
The trial happened only 1 year after the dictatorship ended. The dictatorship had control of all the media in the society, so there's a big part of the society who did not know yet the horrors of the way they governed the country and all the killings. And Argentina came from 50 years of coup d'etat against democratic governments, so the idea of the militaries coming back to the power, it was certainly possible. So it was a great decision by the government, and it took a lot of bravery to decide to make this trial, and it was super important to build the new democracy. The context was awful. All the other countries in the region were still governed by dictatorships. And that this trial happened, it was a miracle that the government started and then the prosecutors and judges did. Mm. But mainly the witnesses that sat there for the first time to tell the society what they lived during their kidnaps.
And some of them were survivors of torture, and there were others who then became known as the mothers of the disappeared, those whose children had just simply vanished. And
The mothers of the disappeared were one of human rights movements that fight for democracy during the dictatorship. They organize themselves and they start to ask where their kids may be. And they keep on working on that. I think 2 weeks ago, they found a boy that was kidnapped when he was born. And I think it was the 200th one they found.
Alive.
Alive, of course. He's a grown up.
Connected to the family.
Yeah.
What was your own connection, Santiago? You must have been a child at the time.
Yeah, I was only 4 years old when the trial happened. I was born in the 80s. But my mother, she worked all her life in justice. So I was raised in the values of the importance of justice to consolidate democracy. It's a subject that I feel very close to the way I was raised. And mostly everyone in my family has been working in politics. And my father were also in politics during the dictatorship, trying to fight for democracy.
It struck me also watching it that this is before the Balkans. And now we've got used to this idea that there are international war crimes processes. But at the time, given that there hadn't been anything really since Nuremberg and Tokyo, you know, it had a wider context, not just for Latin America and South America, but globally.
Yes, I think it was the first one of its kind that a civil court judged a military dictatorship. and they could convict. I think it's one of the things that Argentinians have to feel very proud about, that this trial happened and the trials keep on going, because that was the first one, and now almost 40 years afterwards, the trials keep on going, and even companies like Mercedes-Benz, who collaborated with the dictatorship, they are managing to convict.
The figure you have at the absolute centre of the film is the film version of the man that we heard in that clip, the prosecutor Julio Strasera, who makes this very powerful closing argument. Tell us more about the real life Julio Strasera and how difficult it was for him living with threats, etc., as he led this.
Julio Strasera was a magnificent character, and all the things that you see in the film are very accurate. He passed away like 9 years ago, but we spoke to most of the people in his prosecutorial team and to some of the judges and his family. It's a sort of story that, like, it's true, but it's super classical, like the second opportunity. He worked in justice during his whole life. He did not do anything during the dictatorship, so he had a sort of guilt because of not doing anything. It was a risky moment for being in the country. I mean, if you want to investigate, maybe you could get killed. But then he has this opportunity of leading this trial, which was also very dangerous. And he has no support at all from the people who were in the justice. So he needed to build up this team with 20-year-old lawyers, or not even lawyers yet.
Yeah, Luis Ocampo, including, who went on to become the international prosecutor. Yeah.
Santiago Mitre talking to Michelle Hussein. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
The path we're on is terribly dangerous, but I do not know where it leads.
Why the game Hogwarts Legacy is causing division among Harry Potter fans a week before its release. It was the battle that helped Soviet forces turn the tide against the Nazis. 80 years on from the Red Army's victory in Stalingrad, President Putin has used the anniversary to claim that Russia is again being threatened by German tanks. Last month, the German government agreed to allow its Leopard tanks to be used by Ukraine against the Russian invaders. Mr. Putin also made a thinly veiled warning to Ukraine's allies that Russia's response in a modern war might not be limited to the use of what he called armoured hardware. Here's our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
Stalingrad was the bloodiest battle of the Second World War, a titanic struggle in which more than 1 million people are believed to have died. It lasted for 6 months, until exhausted Nazi forces surrendered on the 2nd of February 1943. Many historians believe it was the turning point that ultimately led to the defeat of Hitler. Today saw military parades in the city, which is now known as Volgograd. President Putin attended a wreath-laying ceremony at the Eternal Flame in the vast complex that commemorates the battle. He lay flowers too at the grave of the Soviet marshal who defended the city. Mr. Putin is keen to cloak his own war in Ukraine with the symbolism of that very different struggle, drawing parallels in a speech.
Unfortunately, we see the ideology of Nazism in its modern manifestation, again creating direct threats to the security of our country. Again and again, we are forced to resist the aggression of the collective West.
By seeking to frame both conflicts as being about Russia's own security, Mr. Putin is trying to tap into the spirit of the Second World War. But one was fought to repel Nazi invaders of the Soviet Union, of which Ukraine was a part. The other is a war of aggression that he ordered against an independent neighbour. The Russian leader's oft-repeated accusations that the democratically elected government of Ukraine represent a modern incarnation of Nazism have been widely ridiculed. Observers fear he may be laying the grounds for expanding mobilisation, which the Kremlin denies, and calling for greater sacrifices ahead of an escalation that Ukraine's intelligence services believe may happen this month or next.
Danny Eberhardt. Last weekend, former NATO commander and retired Army General Petr Pavel easily won the Czech presidential election. He's due to take up his post in March. But he said that as things stand, he won't be working in the presidential offices in Prague Castle because he thinks they've been bugged. He wants the castle swept for listening devices before he agrees to move in. Our Prague correspondent Rob Cameron told me more.
He has suspicions about some of the people that have surrounded the outgoing president, Milos Zeman, over the past 10 years. For example, there is one of Mr. Zeman's advisers, Martin Nejedli. He is the former head of a company called Lukoil Aviation Czech. The clue is in the name. It's a subsidiary, or was, of Russia's oil company, Lukoil. He has his own office at Prague Castle, the seat of the Czech president, and he has until recently used a diplomatic passport. That's just one indication of one person, and there are several about whom President-elect Petr Pavel has concerns, not just the personnel, but the whole protocol and security apparatus at Prague Castle. And that's what he wants investigated before he moves in.
So that's the presidential staff. What are relations like between Mr. Pavel and the president himself, Milos Zeman?
Non-existent. I've got a copy here of the congratulations that Milos Zeman sent to Petr Pavel via his spokesman. It says, "Dear Mr. President, I congratulate you on winning in a democratic election. It is my wish that you will be a good president. Yours, Milos Zeman." So not very warm statement. And this is, what, 5-6 days after the election, the two men still haven't spoke.
And tell us what relations between the Czech Republic and the likes of China and Russia are likely to be under President Pavel, because he said the West must accept that China is not friendly.
I think we can expect certainly something of a cooling between relations between Prague and both Russia and China. Obviously, with Russia, they're pretty much non-existent at the moment, and they were pretty bad even before the invasion of Ukraine. And relations with China, really not that much better either, and certainly will get worse if Mr. Pavel continues in his diplomatic outreach towards the leaders of Taiwan. And we've heard that the head of the lower house of the Czech Republic is going to visit Taipei. If Mr. Pavel did, then I think that would really be extraordinary. But there's actually no suggestion yet that that would happen.
Rob Cameron talking to me from Prague. The electoral authority in Nigeria is concerned that ongoing fuel shortages could affect preparations for elections later this month. Millions of people there rely on petrol, not just for transportation, but for generators to power homes and businesses. Fuel prices have skyrocketed in the past few months. The government blames independent oil marketers, who are responsible for selling and distributing it. Yemisi Adegoke reports from outside a petrol station in Lagos.
It's just gone 5 o'clock in the morning here in Lagos, and while millions of people are just getting ready to start their day, others have been up for hours queuing for petrol.
I'm here since 11:30 yesterday, but now this is 5 a.m. I don't even sure maybe they will still sell the fuel or not.
I came here as early as 5 minutes after 3 a.m. this morning, hoping I'll be the first to be on the line. When I got here, I was surprised to see myself number 18.
There are about 70 cars in this queue, and the filling station isn't even open yet. It's a clear sign that the fuel scarcity that has gripped the country for the last couple of months has no signs of easing up. It's been a really tough time for many Nigerians.
I slept here. There's no other way, so I have to do it.
Are you confident that this station will sell petrol to you?
We don't even know that. Maybe they will sell or not. We just queue.
I wonder how a man of my age, 72 years, will come and queue up for fuel by 4:30 a.m. in the morning. It's unfortunate.
This is a country with low power supply, so millions of people rely on generators to run their households and businesses. In addition, transportation costs have skyrocketed. If that wasn't bad enough, fuel prices across the country are also fluctuating. The official pump price is 170 naira per litre, but we've been getting reports that people are paying anywhere between 185 naira per litre up to 400 naira per litre.
There's no money. There's nothing. This fuel shortage has caused problems. We spend less time at home with our families. We have no money to feed. There are no jobs. Nothing.
What will happen if you don't get fuel at this station?
I'll go look for an alternative. That is black market.
So I blame the government for it.
Now, what's the government saying about this? According to them, they haven't officially raised the price, and it should still be available at 170 naira per litre. They also say that there are enough petroleum products to meet the demands of the people. Instead, they lay the blame at the feet of the independent oil marketers, who are in charge of selling and distributing the product. In turn, the marketers blame the rising cost of the dollar and the high cost of transporting petroleum across the country. Well, whoever's to blame, it's Nigerians like this that are paying the price.
Let me see. Adegoke in Lagos. Now, a story for Harry Potter fans and gaming fans. Next Friday sees the release of Hogwarts Legacy, described as an action role-playing game.
The path we're on is terribly dangerous. But I do not know where it leads.
Players will be able to choose their appearance, house and gender, and customise their character's voice and body type. They can also choose to be trans, which raises questions about the attitude of Harry Potter creator J.K. Rowling, who has famously been drawn into the divisive debate about gender identity. The author isn't involved in the game, but its makers say they've collaborated closely with her team. Evan Davis spoke to gaming journalist Jake James Lugo and to Stacey Henley, editor-in-chief of The Gamer magazine. First, what is Stacey's view of the game?
Yeah, obviously people are very excited about it. You know, Harry Potter is a huge franchise. At The Gamer, which is my website, we are not covering the game at all. We're not doing reviews like guides, which would be our main source of revenue for a release like this. And the reason we're not is the fact that Harry Potter and the world that Harry Potter exhibits is entirely connected to J.K. Rowling. But she has a platform that she uses to push transphobia, that she uses to build up what I suppose I would call a campaign against trans people, especially in Britain. So for me, it's not a case of you shouldn't enjoy this game. It is supporting this game continues to give J.K. Rowling a platform with which she can use to hurt people.
And it's more that than the royalties that she's going to earn from the...
She's already very rich. We don't know how the royalties work. We don't know if she was paid up front. We don't know if she gets any dividends. We don't know if there's a percentage clause where if it sells a certain amount, she gets more money.
Would you like Harry Potter, the whole thing, consigned to history?
No, not at all. Harry Potter is such a crucial part of so many people's lives. There are people in the world who've only read 7 books, and they all start with Harry Potter. And I understand how important the books and the movies and all the other things are to literally millions of people. You know, if something that was really special to my childhood was taken away from me because the creator suddenly outed themselves as having these quite nasty views, it would be heartbreaking. So I don't want people to burn their books, but I think moving forward, you're not being asked to give up all those childhood memories. What you're being asked to do is think of the impact of continuing to support future endeavours.
Jake James, you're a Harry Potter fan. You're a game fan. You're going to buy this game, right?
Actually, I'm going to get the game. I'm going to cover it because, you know, partially it's my job to cover all the latest releases, especially popular ones that this one has become up to this point. It's now the highest pre-ordered or one of the highest selling games on places like Steam, on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X. So I'm going to have to cover it at some point.
What are your views, though, about separating the art from the artist?
Yeah, it is a very important issue, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think where the issue that a lot of people have that they're viewing this game is that there's a lot of people that probably feel differently because they want to play the game. They're fans of Harry Potter. They're fans of the Wizarding World in general. Probably don't care for J.K. Rowling herself. The problem is, though, is that they're being vilified. I think the majority of people are just trying to enjoy a piece of medium, and they don't want to be told that there's something that they're not.
And you feel there's a bit of social pressure to take a particular view about J.K. Rowling and to take a kind of boycott stance as a result of that.
Again, I don't think anybody has a problem with other people boycotting the game. I do think that on social media, especially in places like Twitter, even on TikTok, there is a pressure right now because there's a lot of noise surrounding this game. There's a lot of different things that are just compounding the entire discussion of this as opposed to actually seeing and judging the game for what it is.
Jake James Lugo and Stacey Henley talking to Evan Davis. Now to a tale of lost songs written in the Second World War by Jewish refugees in Central Asia. The Yiddish manuscripts were confiscated by the Soviet secret police and thought to have been lost. Decades later, singer and violinist Alice Zawadzki has travelled to Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan in search of those songs for a BBC documentary.
This is a song called Kazakhstan. It's in Yiddish, from a collection of other songs also in this language, which were confiscated after World War II by the Soviet secret police, or KGB. Back then, the KGB accused those who sang these songs, and those who collected them, of being anti-Soviet Jewish nationalists. Oh. This is the first time in more than seven decades that the song has been heard in Kazakhstan itself, since it was created there in 1945. More than 1.6 million Jews ended up in Kazakhstan and other parts of Central Asia during World War II. They were fleeing the Nazis, some on foot, some by cart, a few in cars, but mostly on masses of trains. And some of them wrote songs and poems. The songs were discovered in recent years by Anna Sternschiss. She's a professor of Jewish studies at the University of Toronto, and they had lain completely forgotten about in the National Library of Ukraine in Kyiv.
I actually started reading those texts, violent calls for revenge, extreme praise for Stalin, extreme anxiety and sadness about losing family members. So all that stuff. And then suddenly I had this thought, why don't I recognize a single one of these texts? I called Dr. Brett Werp, who works as an ethnomusicologist at the United States Holocaust Museum. And I read to him some on the phone, and he says, well, Anna, congratulations. What you're reading is actually the collection that we thought was lost.
The songs were collected by a team of Soviet folklorists based in Kyiv, led by Moisei Beregovsky. But in Central Asia, this work wasn't done by professionals, but by individuals who had heard of Beregovsky's project. The songs were written down in factories and collective farms, and sometimes even in synagogues. They included their own account of the unfolding of the Holocaust as it was happening in the Nazi-occupied areas of the Soviet Union. But of all those created in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, only one of the songs talks about their surroundings, Kazakhstan.
The first line of this song, Kazakhstan, says, it was a storm wind that brought me to Asia.
And the song begins with the mountains that protect you. And the song says that everywhere else in the world, a Jew is an outcast. And here, and with these words, the song ends, a Jew is a brother and a member of a family.
I'm standing at a rainy mountaintop cemetery here, looking down on Almaty, and there's something about that first metaphor that really pierces my heart. In a time when this part of the world is once again clouded by the tragedy of war unfolding close by, there are some things that can only be said through poetry, and some things that can only be understood through song.
Alice Sawadzki. That's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Matthew Dean and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.